Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Okay, everyone, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I have the pleasure of having with me another return guest. Many of you remember her from the end of season two, where she and I spoke about parent-child enmeshment. At that time, she was actually up in the Seattle area visiting her son. And now she's back home down in the southern part of the United States. And it's a clinical psychologist and author, Dr. Margaret Rutherford. And she has a book called Perfectly Hidden Depression. And so she's on today to talk about how perfectionism can actually be masking depression instead of some of the other mental conditions or behaviors that we associate with a lot of different, a lot of other things. And I know that when she mentioned this to me in our last interview, it was surprising for me, because when I think of, perfectionism, depression is not actually the first thing that comes to my mind. And so I'm excited to have her back on, because she wrote this book, and let me grab it for the video people that are watching. This is what the cover looks like when it doesn't have a glare on it, but there you go. Links will be in the podcast notes. But she's here to talk about what she's seen and how this could be something maybe for those of us that are dealing with high levels of perfectionist behaviors to maybe chart a different course in addressing it and treating it. So thank you, and welcome back to the show, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Ami. I appreciate it so very much. And, you are not alone. You're far from alone. In fact, probably every therapist that has interviewed me for this book has said, I learned that perfectionism was about anxiety. And that's why I thought this book was so important, because I do think that a perfect looking person, someone whose strategy is to sort of develop this persona, does mask depression. And in fact, there's lots of research showing that perfectionism and suicide rates are linked, and that both are going up dramatically. So it's a huge concern. And I was contacted by some folks in Florida 2 or 3 weeks ago that told me that there were two women, and one who's really good friend died by suicide. And she was exactly the kind of person I'm talking about in the book. She was successful. She was engaged. She was caring. She loved her children. She was known to be, generous and kind-hearted and incredibly industrious. And after her death, her husband looked on her bedside table to try to find some answers, and my book was there. Wow. So that story took my breath away. My tears sprang to my eyes, and it's made me even more determined to get this message out that perfectionism is not always about anxiety, but it's about a strategy, an unconscious strategy to rise above painful emotions and suppress them. And then you unfortunately lose the ability to even connect with them in any way until they grow more potent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, and so I've got goosebumps from that, because, hearing again, when we've all thought of perfectionism in one way, and usually, and I know this, and I'll speak from this personally, and it's not myself, but it's, with my daughter, anxiety is sometimes what we see, right? Like, we see the behaviors. And so we say that must be the condition going on, and not realizing that it's like this, depression feels, when I watch it in somebody, it's like this low hum under the surface that isn't always as obvious, that just kind of vibrates out things that can kind of guide us and mislead us. But it's, you know, this underlying current. And, you know, when I started to recognize, even my daughter thought she had anxiety, but as we really got into the root, we really saw, and through therapy and through psychiatry, saw the depression really deeply underneath there, that how she expressed it was in a way that could be, like, you know, defiant behavior, you know, anxiety behavior, all that other stuff really kind of zeroed in. So I can see this, where this could be the case, but I will tell you, like I said, right away, you know, depression isn't the first thing that I thought of. I thought of like obsessive compulsive disorder. And I thought of, you know, again, anxiety, you know, those anxiety types of disorders. When did you start to see this kind of coming out, and how did you start to make these links and connections together?
I tell the story in the book. It's, in fact, it's the preface to the book or the intro, whichever's first. A story about a young woman that I saw probably mid-30s. She was very successful in her business. She had two children. She came in, talked about some things in her past. I diagnosed her with an anxiety disorder. We did some, I thought we were sort of doing some good work. And then I got a call from her husband, back when we used to actually call each other. I got a call from her husband saying, there's something wrong. There's something dreadfully wrong. And I said, what? He goes, I'm out of town. I'm on my way back. And I know this is completely weird and strange for me to ask you to do this, but I need you to go check on her. And I said, well, maybe I should call 911. He goes, no, she'll be so mad if, you know, because again, she looked very well put together. So he gave me their address and garage code, and I walked into her house, calling her name softly, feeling like a burglar or something. But everything was beautifully arranged. There were dishes drying in the sink. There were throws artfully thrown over the sofa. There were toys put up, but eerily quiet. And as I walked to what I assumed was their master bedroom part of their house, I saw her in bed, and she had taken pills. And I had no indication that she was depressed, absolutely none. She now tells me that I saved her life in many more ways than one, that she also turned her life completely around. And we talked much more in depth. And I wish I could say at that moment, all these light bulbs went on and I thought, okay, I've got to write a book about this. But that was years ago. But it did raise my awareness that some of the people that perhaps looked a little too good to be true and had so much difficulty expressing painful emotion, not identifying it, but expressing it, that I needed to pay more attention. I needed to dig a little deeper. I needed to make sure I was asking the right questions. So I sat down, I started in social media back in 2012, and I sat down one day and wrote a post about these people. And I just sort of thought of the term perfectly hidden depression, not a term I'd ever seen before. Well, at that point, and the title was "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One?" And at that point, I was getting about 50 shares or something like that. I was really dancing up and down if I got that many. Well, this went viral. And then it was on the Huffington Post about 2 weeks later, and I got hundreds of emails. And so I began thinking, wow, I need to pay more attention to this. This must be something that I really want to try to look into. And I found Brené Brown, of course, her wonderful work. I found a book by Terrence Real called I Don't Want to Talk About It, which is a great book, especially for men. It's written for men about covert depression. But I couldn't find anything, especially in the popular literature, that actually linked perfectionism and depression and even maybe suicidality. I could find it in the research literature. There was plenty of, you know, scholarly literature, right. And there were workbooks written for perfectionists, but nobody talked about the why. Mm-hmm. How had this gotten started? And once you look into the how, that's when you find the depression. Because what is happening, and there are cultural aspects of this, there are social aspects of it, certainly, but the one I really focused in on was the personal aspect, the familial aspect. And there are lots of roads to Rome, but one can develop this mainly as a strategy we're all born into certain kinds of families. Some are wonderful, some are iffy, some are abusive. But basically these children go through something where then they develop this strategy that they must be highly accomplished. They must suppress, ignore, avoid, deny any kind of pain they're in, emotional pain. And they get so good at it that it becomes unconscious. Mm-hmm. It becomes something they're not even aware they're doing. And they lose the ability to connect, or what's another word that's an even better word to express? I'm getting stuck on those two words. Whatever is in their life that is troubling or frightening or makes them angry. And so they look perfect. Their lives look perfect. They're really successful. They count their blessings. They are very responsible, uber responsible. They do worry, but they don't like to let people in on how much they worry. So they just maintain a lot of control, which helps them with their worry. They stay in their head. These people are highly analytical. They're very comfortable in that mental world. Mm-hmm. They're a great friend. But they have lots of empathy. They're going to be the first person who, when something happens, they're the ones who are bringing the gift cards to fast food so your kids can eat. I mean, they're really wonderful friends, but they just don't let anybody into who they are. Mm-hmm. And this starts very early. And so I sat down after this sort of caught on, and I thought, I just sat down and started writing more blog posts about it. And that led to this book, because the blog posts have done extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Right. He's kind of tapping in. You know, it's listening to this, and I sit there and think about how challenging then it must be, really, because, you know, in the therapeutic process, you know, and I speak as the client, not as a therapist, because I'm not a therapist. But, you know, my therapist only knows what I'm able, but part of it's what I'm willing to share, right? And so willingness is something that a lot of people have to get over with before they go into therapy. Like, you have to have a willingness to be vulnerable and raw, and that's uncomfortable, which is, you know, maybe why some people choose to not go therapy. And then when you get into therapy, the quality of that relationship is also based on ability of the participant, me, to know how to communicate what I think is relevant, because you walk in, how's it going? And I have to filter through, what do I need to share today? What do I think is relevant to the conversation today? And then my therapist, you know, that relationship that you then have to build where they get to know you, not just what you tell them, but they get to kind of start to backfill in their observations of you to be able to help you, you know, get through some of that, then you're able to kind of go on. But if you're so good at not recognizing what's really relevant to bring to the session and to talk about, then it just, you never get to the bottom of it. Right. And I can see where people can spend years in therapy, never really getting to what it is that they need to go. And in this case, it sounds like that's what you're describing, is this condition of everything else seems fine. We're groomed to believe everything is really fine. And yet there's something not fine, but we don't even know where it begins and where it belongs. And we, you know, are addressing, you know, this problem here and ignoring really the kind of, again, that low underlying hum, you know, deep in the chest that could be, you know, resonating out of there. So how do you tackle that with somebody who's not bringing it, who's like unable? And I don't mean ability. And I think people should, this is important for me to say, your ability isn't your intellect or your intelligence, but language, right? It's like not being able to show up and speak Spanish because you've never been taught it. Don't beat yourself up that you can't speak Spanish. And in some ways, our emotional language is something that we didn't get taught that. And so how do you work with somebody that you come in and you think that this could be it, but you can't penetrate, you know, and kind of get in, you know what I mean?
I understand exactly what you're asking. And you know, I have had people comment to me, well, how, as a therapist, how am I supposed to know that something exists in this person if they don't talk to me about it? And so, you know, but what you look for is the absence of things. I mean, I so distinctly remember this woman was a lovely person. She actually had participated in a lot of beauty pageants. And in so doing, she also had developed a severe eating disorder. And that's what she came in for, because she was binging and purging, and so much so that it was affecting her health. But I had asked her some of the normal questions in the first session, one of which is about any history of sexual abuse, and she denied it. And about the third or fourth session, she came in and she said, well, you know that question you asked me about sexual abuse? And I said, yeah. She said, well, you know, and she was smiling brightly. She said, well, you know, I was raped the week before I went to college, and somebody put something in my drink, and I was dragged out to the beach and raped, and I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning and realized what had happened, and I just never told anybody, and there was a smile on her face. Oh. And I looked at her, and I said, why are you smiling? And she said, well, you know, so many people have that happen to them. And it was the drug, and I never blamed myself. And it just didn't seem important. And I was excited about college.
Oh my gosh.
And I looked at her and I just said, you know, if I turned the sound down of this session, if I'd been recording it, it would have sounded like you were ordering your lunch or telling me what you'd eaten for lunch. Not that you were brutally raped years ago. And she just looked at me sort of stunned. And I said, that's where we need to go. Now, was that happenstance? You know, I'd ask a good question, which she pondered, and then sort of, you're right, you're not always going to ask the right questions. But as a therapist, or as a friend, or as a spouse, or as a teacher, or as a doctor, you can begin to notice the way people are talking about their lives, how they are describing their lives, and are they leaving out things that might be, again, frightening or unpleasant or troubling or grief, you know, cause grief or shame. These people are intensely fueled by shame. They have a constant critical voice in their head. And we can get to how that makes it different than good old regular perfectionism. But, and so it's their shame saying, don't talk about that rape. That's silly. You know, you're just feeling sorry for yourself. You know, you're making a big deal out of something that was just happens to one out of every four women. So just get over it. And so it is what they are not that is, and what they cannot do. You notice you're saying the word capability or ability. They don't have the capability until you help them learn it to connect with these feelings and experiences and memories. And in fact, they're quite frightened to do so, afraid that they will lose their sense of competence. They'll lose their sense of status. They'll lose, people will think ill of them if they're not constantly in control.
Mm-hmm. And do people worry about the fear of, let's call it a stigma about backsliding into your past and starting to conjure up the ill future of like saying, listen, I've already gotten over that. Like, it sounds like to her, she feels like, you know, I've risen above that. It wasn't my fault. I've validated it. I've experienced it and I've moved on. What's the point in going backwards with all of that? And there is a little bit of that shaming out there of like, why do you keep talking about the past? Like, you know, move on and move forward. And do you have to worry? Cause that sounds like a little bit of like, that could be one of those mental blocks that somebody puts in of like, I'm smiling because I'm over it, man. I achieved everything. Like, I survived it. Right.
Yeah, you're over it. And you go home and you eat huge quantities of food and you make yourself throw up constantly. And that's right. Getting over something. This particular woman also told me she had two different sets of friends, the people that she could be a little more real with, still not really real. And then this group of friends that didn't know her at all, but she, you know, anyway, so she had her life completely compartmentalized. The answer to your question is that good therapy is not about blame. It's not about going into the past and thinking, you know, if this hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't have done this. And I'm going to stay mad about it and sad about it. It's going to govern the rest of my life. Good therapy is about acknowledgement. It's about going back and saying, if this happened to any child, how would that child respond? How would that child be frightened? A man comes to mind who was laughing, just uproariously laughing, and telling me about how his mother used to throw rocks at him. Big ones, not even pebbles, not like a game they were playing, like big rocks. And then screaming at him, he'd never amount to anything. And he was laughing, and he said, yeah, well, you know, I bet she, you know, I wish she could see me now. And I looked at him, I said, so you have grandchildren, right? He goes, yeah. I said, so if I handed you a big rock and I said, throw it at your grandchild, what would you do? And he said, well, that's preposterous. I would never do that. And I said, why? He said, because it would scare him. I said, right. Right. Your memory of it is something you laugh at, but as a child, it was abject fear and rejection and sadness and confusion. And that person is still in you. And the connection I had to help him make was that he had been extremely successful professionally, but he had retired and he was falling apart. Literally falling apart because there was no way now that he could go out to the world and prove that he had made something of himself, that he didn't have that structure anymore of his profession to help fight that battle with his mom that was still raging within him. And once we acknowledged that, he just sort of melted and he could have compassion for that child. And he, now it takes several sessions. This didn't happen overnight. But he began doing yoga and he began working with his wife. I mean, it was just this, it was a wonderful transformation to see, but it wasn't until he could connect the dots between that little boy who had been so confused and frightened and this part of him that was still extant that was struggling without that constant affirmation of his being an important, good person. That he had to deal with these voices of shame inside of his head.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I've seen this a lot. I have, you know, in conversations, you know, inevitably it's hard for me to go sit down with drinks with anybody anymore and not start talking about everybody's background. So, but you do see this, you know, kind of the big hurdle, you know, that I always try to talk to everybody about is your adult self looking back on everything certainly can rationalize it in a different way. Right. And when you're in what, you know, I feel like sometimes what I try to do and what my show is an attempt to do is to realize that there are two versions of you. There is you today, cognitively adult thinking about situations and responding, and that inside of you is that inner child. And I think sometimes people view it as like inner child as some sort of woo-woo statement. And that's why I always try to link it back to science. Like, no, we're talking about a nervous system architecture constructed during childhood by the inputs that it received. Like adding apps to your phone, that's the way the brain comes around. So if your brain was in a polluted, toxic state of stress, sorry, you've got a bunch of viruses on your phone, AKA your brain that you're working with, right? And so it, like that gentleman's story right there of, you know, when you get somebody to go back to, I know today it wouldn't scare you if an adult threw a rock at you because you're you're an adult, right?
Depends on how big the rock is.
Right, yeah, of course, yes. Of course. But your responses are different than being that pure small child, sure. You know, and that's what is really, you know, the influence in there. You know, so I see that, and I see that with a lot of people. And I think this is a good conversation for people to, you know, kind of have to say, you kind of need to split off and remember not what you remember of it, but imagine. And I love your example of there, like, if it's hard for you to remember what it felt like to you, just be an observer of it happening in front of you.
Right.
And what do you think you would see on a child's face whose mother is standing there throwing a rock at them? Like, you know, because that is probably easier for people to link if they can't get into themselves. And maybe depending on the expense of the trauma that they have, it is kind of hard for sometimes people to get back to those actual memories. Because I know some people are fogged, right? Like their defense mechanism is also kind of blanked out memory access and stuff for some people, depending on how severe those traumas are.
I often ask people to go back and find old pictures of themselves, or like you say, to notice the children around them and their vulnerability. And I gave that assignment to a guy one time who had come in because he was suicidal, but definitely was part of this rubric of perfectly hidden depression. And he had done a lot of good work, but he said he found this picture and there was still this part of him, because he felt like he'd made so many mistakes and he could not forgive himself for that. He was very shame based. And he said, what I'd whisper to that little boy right now is, don't grow up. You know, you're going to make so many mistakes. Just stay six. It was as if being imperfect, being human, was something that he could not tolerate. And so he had built this life where it looked pretty perfect. He had the perfect home. In fact, he said people would always come up to him and say, you just got everything. You've got the great job. You've got the great marriage. You've got the great kids. You've got, you know, well, he was having serial affairs. And so, you know, which were completely hidden and eventually was found out. And that's why he landed in my office. And he did not have a sexual addiction, but there was this part of him that was very hurting. And so, and sure enough, he'd grown up in a home where no one was allowed to talk about their feelings at all. And it was all about accomplishment, and it was all about who you were in the community. And that's what he swallowed hook, line, and sinker. And then he tried to live out that life, and it just didn't work. It had no depth to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to ask you, because you had shared a couple of examples of women, and now you've shared some men, because I was wondering whether or not this is something, do you see broad across men and women, or have you seen in your practice, I know you can't speak for, you know, the entire population, but within your practice, is it broad for men and women, or are more women or more men?
If you look at the perfectionism research, it will say that there are more women that are perfectionistic than men. But it's interesting, you go, some other multicultural studies do not show that. They show it, so in the United States, it looks more like a female issue. But especially, you know, with imposter syndrome being so big in for women. But I think it's both genders have this issue, and it can be painful. And again, I'm not a researcher, so but I have contacted Gordon Flett and Paul Hewitt and some of these other people who are doing wonderful work on perfectionism. In fact, they're international experts on perfectionism. And I would recommend to your listeners any kind of research by them, or they actually have some books. But, you know, they have been very supportive of this, because this particular issue, even with Brené Brown, Brené Brown's work, it's still by the popular, it's not in the popular literature much. So they were welcoming that, and that feels good. I will say that certainly perfectionism in and of itself has been growing with every generation, but this particular generation now, there are definitely exponentially more people talking about, oh yes, I have to be better than everyone else. I have to look thinner. I have to look more successful. I have to look happier. A lot of that influences social media.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very easy to project onto other people this, your own insecurity, and think of them as having it so much more together than you do. But I think this existed way before social media does. In fact, my mother, I would definitely count her in this group, which of course we all write about our mothers, right? So I eventually wrote a book about my mother, which she would not be pleased about, actually.
I think we touched on that in the last interview. We talked about our enmeshments. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I have been, the people that have come to me because of this, now I live in a fairly small area of Northwest Arkansas, but have been both men and women. So I have seen it in both, and it can be just as hard for one as the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, socially and culturally, it's how it's manifested or how it appears on the outside may be different too. You know, I think of like you said social media. It's like it's women on Instagram trying to, you know, or on social media posting about the wonderfulness of their children, their life, how well they're handling the pandemic. You know, whatever it may be, and men, you know, probably likely would exhibit in a culturally appropriate way for them, which is less on social media and more maybe posturing at work and, you know, in somewhere in the community or, you know, someplace. So I could see that where you might think it's one, but it's really, you know, probably both. We just, again, we judge based on what we can see, right? We don't right. have time to judge based on what's going on in everybody's inner world. We only have like a few seconds to pass judgment on everybody. Right. And so it's fast and it's based on just what we've got, you know, right in front of us. So I, how is this different than, this is one of my questions that I wanted to ask, because, you know, having a sense of pride and feeling accomplished, really being goal oriented is not always unhealthy. So where are we getting from it being, you know, not a problem, but starts to get into the kind of the unhealthy, you know, areas sure. of all that.
Sure. Well, basically striving for excellence or perfectionism and just wanting things to go really well. I'm extremely perfectionistic. I mean, I will redo an email if it's the English isn't, I can hear my Aunt Margaret saying that's not proper English, Margaret. So I redo it. But I think that people like that can see striving as a process. They see it as a learning curve. They see it as, if I don't do well, it's okay. I'll learn from that. I really wanted to do the best I could do, but there's a drive, but there's not a judgment. When it begins to come into a problem, it's because, again, this voice of shame is fueling it, the voice of fear. If this isn't perfect, that means you're not perfect, and that's unacceptable. And so it becomes very goal-oriented rather than process-oriented. And in fact, someone who, let's say they reached their goal, let's say they were heading up a fundraiser that was supposed to make $100,000. Let's say they make $105,000. That, instead of that being something where they kind of sit back and go, wow, look at what we did. Isn't this great? You know, they'll say, well, if I hadn't have done X, then maybe we would have made $110,000. And so they automatically begin to discount. And then also, what research shows is that these folks have what's called socially prescribed perfectionism, which is different from self-oriented. Self-oriented perfectionism means you just want to be as good as you possibly can be. It can be overly perfectionistic, but it's still something that is about the self. Socially prescribed perfectionism is about, I have to constantly meet the expectations of others, and the expectations of others get higher and higher and higher and higher. So I'm on a treadmill that I cannot get off of because I am too scared that people would see me as fragile or weak or not in control. And so you just keep going faster, faster, faster. And that can be a real problem. So I think that the concept of socially prescribed perfectionism goes very well and describes very well that when it becomes more of a problem. And actually, socially prescribed perfectionism is more linked with suicide. So,
yeah. Oh, that's terrible. Now, you have five stages of, you know, and again, I'm going to refer back to the book. So for the listeners, again, book link will be in here so you can go through the book. And like Margaret and I talked about before the show started, we would be here for hours if we went through everything. So I'm trying to make sure that we tackle this so that, you know, those of you that feel like this is resonating inside of you of like an area to explore, that you can pick her book up and get into this. But you outline a five-stage process for healing and addressing, and you call it PHD, perfectly hidden depression. What's this process look like of unpacking, you know, kind of coming to an awareness that this may be you, and then unpacking and addressing and
sure.
I would say handling it, because that's impossible.
I'll tell you my story first. New Harbinger was interested in the book, and they eventually published it. And by the way, it's a much better book because they were involved. And they said, well, we're interested in the book, but, you know, I had written the book proposal as a description of something. I was trying to describe what this condition was. And they said, well, that's not enough. We need a treatment strategy, and we need it in 2 weeks.
Hope you're a perfectionist and you can get that done.
I mean, my heart stopped. It was right before Thanksgiving. I had these guests coming for Thanksgiving dinner. I was just paralyzed for a while. But I pulled up my big girl panties, I guess, and I said, okay, So I literally outlined what I believe are the five basic stages I do with almost everyone. And then I applied it to this particular problem. And the five steps, if they wanted it sort of marketable, which is distasteful to me. But so I called it the five C's of healing. Very marketable, right? But they all made sense. It wasn't like made up. Consciousness is the first one, and that's really what we've been talking about almost the whole episode, is that you have to see that perfectionism is and that shame, that your shame is constant, and that you have to accept it as a problem. You have to become aware that, yes, you have hidden behind perfectionism, but it is dangerous to you. You have to accept that, and that really becomes when you start tuning in to your own you called it the hum a few minutes ago, this sort of constant editorializing that your brain does. Well, that was good, that was bad, you shouldn't have said that, why did you just laugh then, because you laughed too loud. I mean, you know, constant shaming. And so consciousness is the first step. The second step is what's called commitment. And with perfectionists, this is especially tricky. You've pointed out several really good points already about the fact that these people firmly and intensely believe that them being in control and looking like they know things and staying ahead of other people and doing things exactly right, they believe that's what makes them important and valuable. And they truly believe if they budge on that, that if they accept that, and if they begin rolling around in their not knowing, in their playtime, in their acknowledging pain, that they will, kind of like a Jenga game, they will just fall completely apart. And so almost every step of the way, they have to find a recommittal process. They have to know, why is this important for me to do, and what am I beginning to experience that may be frightening at first, but it's actually opening me up and I can breathe more freely. So commitment is the second choice, second stage. The third stage is really based on cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm suggesting that people look at the rules of their lives, the musts, the shoulds, the oughts, the have-tos, nevers, alwayses, and begin to look at how even the ones that are small and the ones that are much larger are governing your life. These are the strategies you came up with again as children, mm-hmm. or you were told you needed to have, and you just keep doing them sort of without thinking. And so you want to begin to look at those roles and to say, what I said rules that you want to apply to your life and make sense in your life now, and don't make any sense. And again, this can go from anything from what you're supposed to wear or not wear to who you're supposed to, what you're supposed to talk about or what you're supposed to not talk about, or what you're supposed to reveal and what you're not supposed to reveal. So you want to look at the rules. The fourth stage is connection. And this is probably, I don't know if it's the hardest, but it's the most alien to these folks, which is to go back with compassion. And the instrument I suggest they're using is what's called a trauma timeline, where you go back and you think of yourself when you were 2 or 3 or 5 or 8 or 13 or 17 or whatever, and you begin to write about the good things that have happened and then the not so good or actually detrimental, destructive, painful things. And you look at both and you begin to see the patterns of, well, if this hadn't happened, maybe this, I wouldn't have perceived this way. Or, and you begin to acknowledge with compassion how all these things affected you, both happy things and joyful things to troubling things. And then you try to stay still. Again, become very mindful and stay still and connect with those emotions. You do a lot of journaling about it. And this is very difficult. And of course, I have to smile a little bit because several people who've read the book have contacted me and said, well, I tried to do the exercises and they were too hard. And I said, well, which ones did you try to do? Oh, I jumped to the trauma timeline.
Shortcutting it.
There are over 60 exercises in this book, and they are basically start out very small and asked to take baby steps. Oh no, well this one seemed like the most important, so I did this first.
Right. It's like, okay, so I just jumped straight to the marathon without buying shoes and jogging around the block first. Right. Yeah.
And so I go, well, maybe we should start go back. And then the fifth one is change, because I'm a firm believer that you get a lot of good stuff from insight, understanding something mentally, cognitively, being able to have light bulbs come on, sort of is the phrase we all use. And where you get your hope, however, is from behavior change. Mm-hmm. When I'm sitting in a committee meeting and at the end of it, and I'm chairing it, and at the end of it, I say, well, you know, I'm not real sure where to go from here. What do y'all think? Or that's what we say in the South. What do y'all think?
I was going to say, that's different than what we say in the North.
Yeah.
What do you all think?
You know, Jim, tell me your ideas. Janice, tell me yours. I mean, to not have to look like, okay, I know where we're going. Or to be seated in a committee meeting and someone says, well, who's going to take on this responsibility? And you literally have to sit on your hands. Literally. And then you have to go out and think, well, you know, I'm no busier than anybody else sitting in that committee, and I should have done that. There's your shame, you know, coming to just eat away at you. And so you don't text somebody, you know, I've thought about it and I have enough time to do that. You know, so you work slowly through these, but where you get your hope is that you see, I did something, I thought something, I felt something different than I'd ever felt before.
Mm-hmm. That's something that we use in coaching, like, you know, when I do like business coaching and stuff like that, because, and I think people don't appreciate sometimes the power of just the stopping, sitting on your hands, hitting a pause button, not doing the thing that you instantly want to do, and how powerful it is to just, you know, not do that, give yourself, some airspace and some breathing room.
Right.
And make a completely, you know, different decision or choice or behavior, and how doing that a couple of times has profound impacts, you know, because again, the science nerd in me is always like, you know, there is a real process of pruning out neural pathways and replacing them with new ones. And that's part of this, you know, gardening of the brain that we do. And CBT, you know, in many different areas, you know, and, you know, sometimes when people feel overwhelmed, you know, I'm sure that this, you know, this is relevant and germane to, you know, the fields too, which is, you know, you don't have to start huge. Like if that whole leap is hard, like you said, you don't have to go straight to the marathon. Start with just one thing. If you notice, like I get triggered in meetings and then I clam up, you know, or whatever that thing is, because when I talk about this, like from professional communication styles and stuff like that, this is usually when people get triggered in a different way, where CBT is the difference. Like, how do you change the dynamic and how do you change how you interact with other people is like, stop, feel it, then do the thing that you probably should do, you know, in terms of like the right answer, like not yell at everybody, but actually, you know,
it doesn't work.
Oh yeah. Me too. That's a good way to get a bad review, you know, at the end of the year. But that fundamental thing, it seems so easy, right? Yet it's not so easy, but yet it's pretty easy. Like, it's not like you have to go scale Mount Everest to make a change. You just have to start doing small changes. And then once you get that reinforcement of like, wow, this actually does change. Now I can add in like 2 blocks to my run. Now I can add a mile to my run. You know, you feel the confidence to be able to continue to just kind of keep growing it and stuff. But CBT is really like, that doesn't work for everybody, but it is a pretty good start to try. And I'm surprised by a lot of people that don't actually employ CBT practices in their healing. They talk about it, they make the connections, but then the actual doing something different, you know, is like that next step that can actually kind of take it from understanding to practical application. And I like what you said, like the hope is there, because you're right. Once you see it and you feel it and you notice that something's different, it does generate hopefulness that it, you know, that it can, that something's going to change for the better. You know,
I love this. I love this quote by Terrence Real, his book. I don't want to talk about it. Sounds like I'm his agent.
I wrote it down too. So
yeah, it's a good book. Really good. The very intense book. But he uses these case histories of his own patients and then has them talk to him. I mean, he literally, it's like reading a therapy session. And one of some light bulbs, again, were coming on from one of his patients, and his patient said, "So you mean if I don't feel it, I live it?" And he said, "That's right." You know, and so if you don't know how to feel something, it's still going to be affecting you, and you're just going to live it out. You're not going to know. I used to use this very silly analogy of living in a big Cheerio. And I don't know why I picked Cheerios, I guess because I like them.
Well,
and,
I'm interested, so yeah. Explain.
That probably has all sorts of Freudian things about me, but anyway. So, and you can't turn around. So, or think of, you know, one of those inner tubes or something, and you push these feelings away from yourself as hard as, with all your might as you possibly could. The only thing they do is they circle around, and now they're affecting you in a way you can't see. They're pushing you, pulling you, whatever. And so the harder you push, the more emotion and memory or whatever has of affecting you. You just don't, I don't know really why I'm doing this. It's just, I am. And what therapy is about is backing that process up and going, okay, let's get this out in front of you instead of behind you. So you know why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just described the hamster wheel, right? Really,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of what came to my mind actually was some people might know, I don't even know if they have these on playgrounds anymore, but they had something like a hamster wheel on playgrounds. There were these big wooden rings. And actually, if you lost your footing, you just got like tumbled around and you came out like bruised, you know, because it was, because this heavy thing with all this momentum and these little tiny kids inside of it. So I was like, yeah, that's actually that seems pretty right. A Cheerio is obviously a little bit
probably softer. Not playgrounds anymore. They've taken away seesaws too, I noticed.
Yeah, yeah. No, too many injuries on there. Now, when we talk about this, as we start to kind of, you know, draw this to a conclusion, actually, this is something that came up. We haven't defined depression. We've talked about how it's not anxiety and it's not these other things, but what is depression? Because I think that for anybody who's never been diagnosed with depression, which I imagine this is where this is going to land, right, is for somebody who's never thought about, whether or not that's actually the guiding, you know, internal hum. What is depression? How do we know that that's a condition that's different than maybe something else?
You know, I've loved doing these interviews because actually I'm figuring things out because people are asking hard questions that I didn't really address in the book, so, which I knew would happen. But classic depression, there's a great quote by Andrew Solomon who says, the opposite of depression isn't happiness, it's vitality. People who are classically depressed don't have a lot of energy. Their mood is noticeably different, sadder, more melancholy, more agitated. They don't enjoy doing things that they previously enjoyed doing, a condition called anhedonia. They're hopeless, helpless, feel at least hopeless and helpless. They're usually, there's sleep and eating issues. There can be suicidality. There's fuzzy thinking. There's indecisiveness. So it's both physical, mental, and emotional. All three realms. Some of the early researchers on perfectionism talked about how really depression shouldn't necessarily be governed, or that's not the right word, identified by only its symptomatology, meaning Sidney Blatt was one of the first people to talk about that perfectionism is, or at least a dangerous kind of perfectionism is another kind of depression, but it is never going to look like classic depression. It's going to look more like a syndrome or the way someone lives their lives or how they live their lives. To my knowledge, he may have talked about that. I just haven't been able to find it. But Anyway, it's important, but perhaps for me to say here, PhD is not a diagnosis. I am not narcissistic enough to believe that I've come up with a whole new diagnostic category all by my little lonesome, you know. That would be ridiculous. So actually, something that can happen frequently is people who are living out perfectly hidden depression can actually become classically depressed, or they can have a classical anxiety disorder. Maybe they have panic attacks. Maybe they have social anxiety. Maybe they have generalized anxiety disorder. They can have eating disorders. They can have problems with substances because they're trying to escape, you know, any kind of feeling they have. So they can struggle with weed or alcohol or something like that. So they can have bipolar 2 disorder. So just because you may identify with perfectly hidden depression doesn't mean that you can't have something that is diagnostically relevant in your life, mentally speaking. So the difference is, well, I copycatted Andrew Solomon's work. And I said, if the opposite of depression is vitality, then the opposite of perfectly hidden depression is self-acceptance. And when I wrote that sentence, I just went, oh, that's right. Because one of the things that people who identify or struggle with perfectly hidden depression don't realize is that their vulnerabilities do not define them any more than their strengths do. Mm-hmm. That both are true. I have two very prominent facts about my life. One is that I've been divorced twice, and I've now been married happily for 30 years. So that's all good. It's all, you know, but I've been divorced twice. Certainly not a claim to fame. And I have a PhD. Great. Worked hard for that. It's allowed me to do a lot of stuff in my life. I'm really pleased I have that. So I have these two things, or this one thing, two divorces that I'm ashamed of, or I have certainly a lot of remorse about. I have a PhD, which is great. I don't think either one of them defines me any more than the other one. You know, hopefully I learned something from both of them. But people with perfectionism and that need to hide these things that they are remorseful about or feel regret about, believe that those things do define them. That if people knew that, if people knew they'd been sexually abused, if people knew that both their parents were alcoholics, if they knew that they'd gotten an abortion, if they knew that, you know, whatever it is, that they would be judged and rejected and lose all their status. So I believe self-acceptance is so important in perfectly hidden depression. It's not that it's not important in classic depression, but because sometimes in managing classic depression, you do have to have a lot of self-acceptance that you've got this disorder that is going to come back. And you have to manage the triggers and do your best to do that. So it's not that it's not part of classic depression, but it's a huge part of perfectly hidden depression.
Mm-hmm. The nuance kind of popped into my head here too, because I believe in conversations I've heard other people express this, that acceptance though is not a declaration of I'm broken and I'm always going to be, or some, again, another thing tinted and laced with shame.
Yes.
Of like, I have a problem, or I, you know, and I know, like I said, there's a nuanced difference in there, but I have heard people feel like they've accepted themselves, but they've accepted it with that specter of shame still wrapped up in all of it.
That's so interesting. That's a great point. And, you know, I would say that's close to, if I'm hearing you correctly, would you say that's sort of close to adopting a victim mentality?
No, you know, I don't think so. I think it feels like more like it could, for some people, I think it could be that I'm a victim, I can't change. And I think, you know, and I don't say I think, but, you know, I can think of a conversation, in, you know, some individuals where they have accepted that they have, you know, certain conditions, that those conditions present hurdles and challenges in their life. They don't feel like it drives them, that they still want and can see a good outcome for themselves in their lives. But when they speak of those conditions, it's still painful. Like there's still shame of like, I should know better, or, like I said, it's nuanced, And I guess that's why I want to bring that up, because I think some people might say, well, I've accepted the fact that, you know, I have whatever this is, OCD, or, this other thing. And therefore I must be okay because I've gotten to that place of acknowledging and accepting it, but yet it still comes with a whole lot of, well, you should know better. And I hear that kind of beating themselves up. You should know better. You should have done better than that. You should be aware of that. Like, I need to fix this. I need to fix this because it's not good enough yet. You know, right. And you know what I mean?
I think I understand now better. I had a supervisor a long time ago. I didn't like him very much, actually. I thought he was pretty haughty, and I was living in Texas at the time, and he did the whole cowboy hat and cowboy boots thing, and, you know, kind of strode into the room, and I was like, who is this guy? Well, and he had written a couple of really good books, so whatever. But he said something in our class. He said, his name was Robert Beavers, by the way, and he said something that I disagreed with. Now, this was in my training in graduate school. He said, shame is a helpful emotion if it lasts for 10 seconds and leads to a change of behavior. And I thought, oh, that's not true. I mean, you want to feel ashamed. I mean, that's the same thing as a good conscience, right? And so you carry it around with you. That's how, I'm ashamed of this. Well, after being a therapist for now, how long have I been a therapist, a psychologist therapist? 27 years. He's right. That if you can't let go, I mean, or work through or acknowledge, accept the fact that something either happened to you that you had no control over, and you might go back and look at it and think, I could have controlled that, but you really couldn't. Or if you did something, literally you did something, you didn't know any better, and you did something that hurt you, hurt other people, that's something that if you learn from it, and if that it does not help to carry it around. And people will say to me, so you're saying that you're not, I'll use my divorces again, so you're not you don't feel bad about those divorces anymore? And I said, well, yes, of course I do. I'll always have that, but I don't carry it around with me. So because it doesn't help me, it doesn't help me have a better interview with you. It doesn't help me write a better book. It doesn't help me. If I'm thinking about that, I'm less likely to see what's available to me today where I can be a kind, generous person or be who I want to be. And so it just weighs you down too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Ah, this has been a delightful conversation.
Well, you know, when you call or contact me, now you can tell how old I am when I say you call me.
yeah, I definitely didn't call you.
When you contacted me again about coming back on, I was so excited because you really are one of, I mean, I don't say this in an empty fashion, your questions are really very pertinent and make me think and go in directions that other people don't go. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, cool. Great. Well, and I'm hoping, like, I learned so much. It's so unfair that I get to do this. But, you know, it's so fascinating, this world. And I appreciate everything that, like, you do, you know, with helping other people out and just anything. And I approach this as I'm asking questions that feel, you know, that I want to know, but I also believe that, and what I hear from listeners is that they're asking questions that they think, but they don't know how to ask or, you know, or raising an awareness here. And this topic here for sure has been a fascinating discovery. And I think we'll actually connect with a lot of people that maybe hopefully can start with that first step of that awareness for themselves, of seeing themselves in a different way. And so I appreciate that you took something that you observed, put it into a book, and are challenging some of the, you know, established viewpoints when we look at something like perfectionism, and maybe hopefully, you know, again, uncovering it. You know, it always seems like we always think we're right at the point, but you can always dig a little bit deeper. And then when it comes to mental health, we sometimes really have to be on it for a long haul and penetrate pretty deeply to finally get to, right. I know for me, that's what it took. It took years of looking at myself and, you know, and reading and to finally go, there it is. I found it. Like, you know, I hit the magma core of all of it and then be able to, you know, come back from that. How do people get to work with somebody like you? Like, how do they find you besides buying the book?
Well, I have lots of material available for people. I have loved being on social media, and in many ways, some of it is a little difficult sometimes, but I started blogging back in 2012. And so that's at my website, drmargaretrutherford.com. And I still post weekly there. I have a podcast called the Self Work Podcast with Dr. Margaret Rutherford that I adore doing. And I really get to go further in depth than I do the blog posts. I do not do guests on my particular podcast. I'll have an occasional guest, but what people seem to really like about it is that it's about 22, 23 minutes long. And it's just me sort of, I do answer some listener questions, but then I'll have a topic I'll talk about for 10 to 15 minutes and just give some case examples and quote some research that I found. And I'm not all talking about me, but I'm bringing research into the topic. There's that. I'm on Instagram. You can email me at askdrmargaret@drmargaretrutherford.com. If you live in Arkansas, I can treat you. I don't know if you have a lot of, maybe you have a lot of listeners from Arkansas.
I don't know. I'd have to go through my stats and see what my Arkansas numbers look like. Cool. And for everybody that's listening, all those links will be back in the podcast notes. So at the bottom of the, you know, when you're listening to this on whatever platform or watching it on YouTube, you'll be able to find her and connect with her.
And the book is available. It's available on Amazon, but gosh, if you want to help out your local bookseller right now, they can order it. It's published by New Harbinger, and you know, it may take a couple of days extra, but that way, you know, your local bookseller will get a little bit of business.
That's good. That's a good point to put in there. Appreciate that. Well, it's been wonderful. Again, thank you so much for talking with me about this, and I appreciate you. I really do.
Thank you, Amen. It's a mutual admiration society. So.
Cool. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Kurakoni, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.